This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Jeff Turner, and I'm the host of On Drugs. Each episode, I dive deep into the history, science, and culture of drugs. We'll cover everything from caffeine to ayahuasca with fascinating detours along the way. It's a brand new season of On Drugs. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app.
Hi, I'm Liz Hoth. This is a podcast from the April 2nd edition of The Current. Rarely has the death of an animal provoked such worldwide fury and condemnation as that of Cecil the Lion. He was shot and killed in Zimbabwe by an American dentist, Walter Palmer, back in 2015.
This magnificent animal was known as Cecil, a 13-year-old lion who was a well-known and much-loved attraction at the Hwanga National Park in Zimbabwe. The animals are protected.
Cecil, with his distinctive dark mane, was a star, the best-known animal in Hwenge National Park. Officials say earlier this month, Cecil was lured out of the protected park with bait, then he was shot.
Well, there's been widespread condemnation, as we've been reporting this morning, of an American dentist who shot and killed a lion in Zimbabwe. It's made most of the front pages of the newspapers here today.
Yes, it appears that Walter Palmer paid £35,000 to go on the hunt. The animal known as...
Everyone here, I get it. When I look at the images of that lion and I think of some rich guy going to Africa on a land where he has no business even, like, with a gun and shooting...
Lots of stars are outraged, tweeting about Cecil's killing. We spoke to Salma Hayek today.
I think that we are in trouble when we take suffering and killing as a sport.
Dr. Palmer was vilified in social media. Protesters even showed up outside his dental office in Minneapolis.
Yeah, we're here today because Cecil was poached in Zimbabwe, and we want this dentist. We want this poacher out of our community. We want him shut down, and quite frankly, we want him extradited to Africa to face justice.
Cecil the Lion may not have become a household name until after his death, but Andrew Loveridge knew the animal for years. He's a zoologist who's been studying lions in and around Zimbabwe's Hwange National Park since 1999. And he's seen firsthand the often contentious relationships between trophy hunters, conservationists, and local villagers. After Cecil's death, Andrew Loveridge set out to uncover what exactly happened on the day he died. His findings are laid out in his new book called Lionhearted, The Life and Death of Cecil and the Future of Africa's Iconic Cats. We reached Andrew Loveridge in Oxford, England. Hello.
Hi there, Liz.
Can you tell me when you first met Cecil the Lion?
So I've been working in Hwange National Park for nearly 20 years now. And about 10 years ago, I first saw Cecil the Lion. He was a territorial male that had just moved into our study area to replace a male that had actually been trophy hunted before. And part of our study is to put radio collars on these animals so we can follow their movements and their lives and their fates over time. And so in November 2008, my wife and I, who was working with me at the time actually, went and tranquilized Cecil and put a radio collar on him. And that was the first time, you know, we'd really kind of got close to him and handled him. And we were to get to know him extremely well over the next 7 years.
And what stood out about Cecil to you?
So, I mean, I think all lions are beautiful, and Cecil was obviously a very, very beautiful lion. I think he wasn't absolutely unique in that he was one of many lions we've studied. And I think at that point we had radio collared 160 lions. So he was 161st. But he was very, very well habituated to vehicles. He lived in a photographic safari area where a lot of tourists come and visit the wildlife, take photographs. He got very, very used to people. Hundreds, if not thousands and thousands of people took his photograph. So he became a very, very famous lion locally.
And then how did you hear that he had been killed?
So I was actually in Oxford in England at the time. And one of my field team phoned up and said, we've just heard that Cecil has been illegally killed in a hunt. which was kind of shocking news because we had thought that there was no hunting in that particular area in that year. And at that point, we didn't really have a lot of detail, and we had to work quite hard to kind of uncover the detail later.
And so what did you find out when you wanted to uncover, when you tried to do that? How did you do it and what did you find?
So Wangi National Park is in a kind of quite a rural part of Africa. It's a big national park. It's a very, very small community of people. And you know, in small communities, the word gets around pretty fast. And so the rumor was out there that a lion had been hunted. We knew that Cecil was one of the lions that lived in that area. And when we looked on our data from our satellite collars, and Cecil was wearing a satellite collar, he had disappeared. So we immediately kind of thought, well, it must be Cecil. We reported it to the authorities, and the authorities said, please can you take one of our rangers and go and actually investigate. And we sent one of our local research staff who has a background in anti-poaching. And he went and he and the ranger investigated the story. And they interviewed several of the hunting staff in the local kind of hunting camp where we thought the hunt had actually probably taken place. And they gave their story. Yes, a lion had been hunted, and these were the kind of circumstances. And at the same time, we'd actually downloaded the satellite data from the collar. So we knew pretty much where Cecil had been in those days, and we could kind of reconstruct more or less what happened.
What do you know then now about how he died?
So we know that Walter Palmer and the local Zimbabwean professional hunter called Theo Bronkhorst had come to the area to hunt a lion. They were probably aware that there was no hunting quota for a lion, and they were doing something slightly dodgy. And they came to this area, and they used a bait to attract the lions to their hunting blind, which is a kind of a hide that they built in a tree to hide themselves from the lion before they hunted it. Walter Palmer was as a bow hunter, and he shot Cecil with a bow and arrow. And unfortunately, at the time, he didn't kill him. We know that Cecil then probably ran away about 20, 30, 40 meters away into some bush and survived for the next 10 hours with a devastating arrow wound before the hunters actually went to finish him off. And they then skinned the animal and took all the parts of the animal away, so there was no evidence to incriminate them. At the same time, they also noticed that the animal had a collar, and this was kind of inconvenient for them because they knew that if they handed that collar in, they'd basically be admitting to having illegally killed the animal.
So you think they knew that this was not a legal hunt?
I'm virtually certain that the local hunter knew. Walter Palmer may or may not have known. We probably will never know.
And that was a difficult death for Cecil too, right? Having been shot and then 10 hours later. Why is such a length in between the time that he was first shot and then finally killed?
I mean, we don't know exactly because we haven't spoken to the actual hunters. But he almost certainly ran away. He wasn't dead. He could move. He moved about 350 meters in the first kind of 5 or 6 hours. It's possible that they couldn't find him straight away, but when we spoke to the hunting tracker, he said that he could hear the animal struggling to breathe. So it was obviously close by, and they didn't bother to go and kill it, to kind of finish it off, put it out of its misery. And we think that Walter Palmer wanted to claim a bow hunting trophy or bow hunting record. And in order to do that, he would submit the trophy record to one of these big hunting associations, and they would record the size of the trophy. But in order to claim it as a bow hunting trophy, he would have to kill it with a bow and arrow. You can't go and shoot it. And I guess they wanted to wait for the animal to die of its initial wound.
So what was that like for you to hear that this lion that you had been tracking for a decade had been killed in this manner?
I mean, I think it's always really distressing to hear that that one of your study animals has died. You really get to know them extremely well. You know, you follow their lives for sometimes many years. And to hear that they've taken 10 hours to die in agony is very, very distressing.
So this wasn't just a distressing story for you. It turned into an international story. I mean, there are many trophy hunts every year. Why do you think this story turned so big?
I think there are lots of different reasons. And I think one of the reasons is that people were just astounded that, firstly, lions are hunted at all. Most people didn't know they were. Secondly, that this animal was mistreated in such a horrible way. And I think a lot of people really just don't understand the motivation for going to kill an animal for pleasure, an animal that's never going to hurt you or you won't eat. And most people just can't really understand that. And so I think that sort of wave of revulsion was a lot to do with that.
I want to play another little piece of tape because everybody seemed to be talking about this at the time. And here's what U.S. late night host Jimmy Kimmel had to say about Cecil's death.
Let's say we accept at face value that he thought it was legal and properly handled and didn't know the lion had a tracking collar. It was a local fair. The big question is, why are you shooting a lion in the first place? I mean, I'm honestly curious to know why a human being would feel compelled to do that. How is that fun?
So that goes back to what you were just saying there. But how surprised were you about the scale of the response to his death?
Well, I think most biologists are used to kind of animal stories maybe making the third page in, you know, sort of a minor newspaper. This was front page news for weeks and weeks. I think in between July and September 2015, there were 100,000 media articles worldwide on this particular animal. And I think that's, to my knowledge, that's never ever happened before for any kind of animal environment or environmental story.
But you'd been dealing with this before because many other lions had been killed by trophy hunters and lions involved in your research.
Absolutely. So Cecil was the 42nd lion that had been radio collared by the study that had been killed by trophy hunters. For all of the previous ones, we'd had almost no response from anybody.
It was not on Jimmy Kimmel.
Exactly. Yeah. Jimmy Kimmel didn't know about it.
Right. So looking at the aftermath of this, a court in Zimbabwe eventually threw out the charges against the professional hunter. Walter Palmer never faced charges. So what do you make of how this case was handled?
I think that certainly the case in Zimbabwe probably wasn't very well handled at all. And the judge threw it out and he said that basically the charges were so vague that that no defense could be mounted. So Theo Bronco especially got off. He's never actually faced the charges. Walter Palmer has not faced charges, although he is still under investigation by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. At the end of last year, we asked them for comment and they said they couldn't provide any comment because the case was still pending.
What kind of impact does trophy hunting, you mentioned the 42 number, but what kind of impact does trophy hunting have on the population of lions?
So for the Wangi National Park, a population is a single most important source of mortality for male lions. So it has a really big impact on lions in Wangi National Park. Probably across Africa, it has a much smaller effect simply because there's not as much trophy hunting and because lions are actually threatened by a lot of other things, you know, primarily by loss of their habitat and coming into conflict with local people and their kind of agriculture and livestock.
I want to talk a little bit about some of those other threats in a minute, but there were other lions that you talk about in your book that you had a real connection to, maybe weren't as famous as Cecil. Can you tell me about, is it Kataza?
Yeah, so Kataza was he started off as a cub in my study when I first actually started the study in 1999 and grew up into a young male lion. And he was one male lion that kind of epitomized the threats that lions face. So he started off, his mother was killed in a poacher's snare, and that obviously put him in danger. He was then caught in a poacher's snare, and he nearly died. I had to rescue him. Dart him, take his snare off and treat the wound. He survived that. He then left the national park and started killing people's livestock. And he came very close to being shot as a problem animal. And I caught him, immobilized him and moved him back in the park. And you know, he fortunately stayed in the park after that. And he was eventually actually shot by a trophy hunter. But he sort of, all those kind of threats that he kind of dealt with and faced are threats that lions face all the time.
And you felt like after all that time, you'd put all that effort into him and then again, another trophy hunter took him down.
Yes, it was very sad because he just survived so much, and it just seemed so unfair that he was then just going to be shot. But, you know, that is the kind of fate that many lions around Wangi face.
So the supporters of the trophy hunting argue that the hunting actually helps conserve wildlife, which seems counterintuitive. Can you explain that argument for me?
That's true. And in Africa, about 1.2 million square kilometers of wildlife habitat is actually set aside for trophy hunting. It's actually more habitat than set aside for national parks. So in terms of actually protecting habitat, which is what conservationists need to do, trophy hunting does do that. But whether it will continue to do that is really a big question, because Africa's changing by the minute. There's 1 billion people in Africa at the moment. In 50 years, there's going to be 2 billion people. And all those kind of habitats are under pressure. And trophy hunting doesn't actually really make that much kind of revenue in terms of covering the costs of conservation. And so there's a threat that it may have, you know, these conservation areas that are used for hunting actually may become farms and agriculture in 50 years' time.
Which would be more of a threat to the animals.
Yeah, lions can't survive in this kind of human-modified habitat. They're carnivores, and they have to eat meat. If there's no zebras and wildebeest to eat, they eat people's donkeys and cows. And that causes people to get very angry and usually kill the lions. So they just don't survive in agricultural landscapes.
I was going to ask about that because it's easy for me to think about lions and preserving them. But what about for the people who have to live so close to them? How difficult is it to live side by side with these animals that can be very vicious?
Yeah, so I think we can't talk about conserving lions without kind of understanding that sort of African perspective of lions. And Westerners think of lions as these, you know, beautiful, magnificent creatures. We sort of think of the Lion King. Africans don't view lions that way at all. Lions are dangerous animals. They kill people's domestic stock a lot. They sometimes kill people. They kill people's kids, and people are frightened of them. And they have have a lot of respect for them. And they don't necessarily want to live with them.
So what do they do?
So we call it human wildlife conflict, and it's something that happens all over the world. It happens in Europe. It happens in America. But you know, when lions leave national parks and they go into sort of communal agricultural land and kill people's livestock, the people retaliate and they kill the lions, and that's a huge source of mortality for most lion populations.
And I mean, that's a real difficulty for them, right? Because they rely on that livestock for food and to survive. So how do you manage that? How do you walk that line of wanting to conserve the animals yet understanding that this is really difficult for the locals?
Yeah, I think most locals would like to just be completely separated from wildlife, and that's not always practical. But we can't conserve the wildlife without kind of looking after the needs of people. So you have to kind of have that balance. People need to benefit from the wildlife ideally in some way, and they also need to be protected from the wildlife. So the one thing that we've been doing around Wangi is we have a program called the Lion Guardian Program, where we employ people in the local community to help local villagers protect their livestock from the lions, and also to chase the lions back into the national park when they leave, and that protects the lions. So they kind of do both those jobs, and that really helps a lot. We've reduced the livestock loss by about half in the last 5 years, which makes a really big difference. And you know, every time you do that, you reduce the need to kill lions.
What's it like for you as somebody that works with lions? Obviously, they're ferocious, but you are working with them and handling them and darting them and collaring them. What's it like to work so closely with these animals?
Firstly, I have a huge amount of respect for them. They're massive animals. A male lion's twice the size of a very big man, and they can shred you in seconds. So you have to be very, very careful. But they're not... they're not needlessly aggressive animals, and they do become very habituated to vehicles, research vehicles or tourist vehicles. You observe them very, very closely. Obviously, when we need to put a radio collar on them, we dart them with a dart gun and a tranquilizer, and only handle them once they're fully tranquilized. And that is an amazing experience in itself, just to kind of get that close to such a magnificent animal.
Have you had any close calls?
I have had lions wake up from the tranquilizer, and certainly when I was first starting out and I didn't have a lot of experience, a young male lion that I just collared, and I was actually moving into the shade of a bush, woke up and started moving around, and that was pretty terrifying for a while.
What did you do?
We ran away.
Okay.
And he ran away as well. So,
oh, you know, the other way, hopefully.
We were both terrified. But,
yeah.
That could have ended badly.
You talk about in your book, you compare the lions and the way they live with each other in their groups to Game of Thrones, the famous book and TV show. Can you tell me a little bit about their societies and why you would compare it to Game of Thrones in particular?
So lions are very, very social animals, and they live in these like very strongly bonded social groups. So the females live in prides and the males live in what we call coalitions, or they're groups of males, often very closely related. And coalitions compete with each other for access to the females, to the prides, and they fight to the death to gain that access. When they do displace a male or a coalition of males, they kill all the pride's cubs. So it's pretty brutal, you know, just a little bit like that sort of medieval kind of chaos in Game of Thrones, and it can be very like that. They don't tolerate another male's cubs. They don't want to raise another male's cubs. They want to father their own cubs as quickly as they can. And that's a big problem with trophy hunting, is that if you shoot the territorial male in a pride, a new male is going to come in and he instantly kills all the cubs. He quite often, you know, fights with the females as well, and he can kill some of the females. So trophy hunting causes a huge amount of disturbance in that kind of quite finely balanced social system that lions have.
And do the males always have that sort of adversarial relationship when always needing to be at the top of the pack, so to speak?
Yes, they do. So males will almost always challenge strange males, and they almost always land up fighting. And occasionally they can actually link up. And so Cecil was an animal that actually formed a bond with a completely strange or strange to him male. So he formed a bond with a male called Jericho, and they kind of formed this little coalition when they were actually quite old animals. And so they can actually form bonds with strangers as well. It's a lot more unusual, but they do it.
And where do the females fit into that whole social structure?
So the females in a pride are almost always very, very closely related. So they're sisters, mothers and daughters. A young female will quite often join her mother's pride, or if the pride's too big, she'll go and try and form her own pride. So they're always closely related, and they compete with other prides to try and hold down the best territory they can find. And if they've got a good territory, they've got a good chance of raising a litter of cubs. Females that have bad territories don't tend to do so well.
So in the book, you ask the question, did anything good come out of Cecil's death? What's the answer to that?
I think prior to Cecil's death and prior to all the kind of, you know, intense media exposure, people were just a little bit unaware that lions are really in quite big trouble. Lion populations have declined by about 42% in the last 50 years or so. There's about 23,000 lions left in Africa. That's far fewer lions than there are African elephants, and everyone's worried about elephants. So I think one of the big things is that you know, we're now aware that these animals are in danger. We need to do something about their conservation. So I think that is a kind of a good thing that has come out of it, and I think that exposure is really valuable for lion conservation. I think it's also exposed some of the bad practices in lion trophy hunting, and I think that the spotlight's really on trophy hunting at the moment. And it's something that I think that needs to change in the way we sort of interact with nature.
So what would you like to see happen now? What needs to change in the short term?
I mean, I think that the really big challenge in African conservation is, how do we fund the conservation? Because African governments are poor. African countries are some of the poorest. African nations are some of the poorest in the world. And they're having to fund the conservation of lions and elephants and all these species that everybody loves. And I think that we really need to move to a system where conservation becomes a global responsibility, and wealthier nations actually take some responsibility for looking after these wild places in Africa that Africans can't really afford to conserve. And many Africans don't want to conserve because they contain these dangerous animals that threaten their lives.
Do you see that happening? How hopeful are you?
I am a little bit hopeful, and I think it is kind of happening already, and there's several big philanthropists who have taken on whole conservation areas and they pay for it. They pay for the conservation. There's an organization called Africa Parks, which currently manages 15 national parks across Africa, and they want to expand their footprint. They take on the conservation entirely, and it's all funded by philanthropic money. Western governments could fund conservation in a heartbeat if they wanted to. It's a fraction of the kind of defense and development spending that governments spend all the time.
Mr. Leverage, thank you so much for speaking with me today. It's been fascinating hearing about your work.
It's an absolute pleasure, Liz. Thank you very much.
Andrew Leverage is a research fellow in the Wildlife Conservation Research Unit at Oxford University. His book, Lionhearted, The Life and Death of Cecil and the Future of Africa's Iconic Cats, will be published next week. I'm Liz Hoth. Anna Maria is back tomorrow. Thanks for listening to The Current.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.